Please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I got to tell you, since I saw you in Boston a few months ago, where I actually saw you speak on this topic and said to myself, this would be a great topic for the show. A lot certainly has happened. Tell me a little bit about where you're going and what you're doing in the speaking circuit, as they would say.
Yeah, so where my core focus right now is on helping companies anticipate what's coming next. The better you can prepare to anticipate what's coming, the more adaptive your plans are likely to be, and the more successful your company is likely to be. So it's what are the trends that are going to reshape the workplace, what are companies doing about it, and what are some ideas that individual companies could consider as part of their response to those trends.
You talk about 10 rules for mastering disruption. Disruption is an interesting word. Why did you choose that word in thinking about the future workplace experience?
I think the disruption, as we've all seen, even recently with Amazon buying Whole Foods, for example, disruption happens when competitors or practices seem to appear out of nowhere and change the game for everyone. And that's the distinction between a disruption and an evolution, where everybody are just looking at trend curves and arguing among themselves as to how fast that trend will take on. So the disruption really is a fancy word for what's likely to blindside us.
Technology is certainly a piece of disruption. You certainly talk about Amazon in that particular case. But a company or an organization that is focusing on the future and focusing on things that engage employees, but also dealing with the day-to-day systems and day-to-day issues, technology has become a big piece of it. How much of the technology part disrupts an employee's relationship to the employer?
Oh, it's massive. Essentially, technology is more critical to businesses than ever before, both from how they deliver value to customers and how they engage employees and how employees are productive. Fundamentally, employees must master new technologies to be relevant, and being able to use technology as an enabler to get work done is essentially a core competency for both companies and individuals. And it is irreversibly transforming how we work, regardless of job role. And so, we identified four different ways that employees could stay ahead of that, and I'll outline them more broadly for you, and we can tuck into them. But one is as an enabler in terms of how you enable workflow, and this is what we call the appification of the workplace, or more recently, we're hearing more about the botification of the workplace, where you have these AI bots start to enter into the workplace and out of a home, such as Alexa, et cetera. The second big driver is as an enhancer. How do you enhance capabilities? People are now thinking about deploying virtual reality to create immersive digital experiences for employees, for training and for getting design work done, or exoskeletons that employees wear to lift large loads, or other wearables, right? These all enhance our capabilities. The third big category is really as an advisor. How do we apply technology to make better decisions? And we've certainly seen a lot about how big data is entering into workplace and completely disrupting the speed at which decisions are made and the types of decisions that are made. And then the last one, which is the big chestnut, is the as a technology as a disruptor. And the whole debate there is what roles will be disrupted, automated, or eliminated, so that companies can avoid having what we'll call their own Kodak moment, where all of a sudden you're relevant one day and the everything changes so much you're completely irrelevant and redundant the next day.
As you stated, and certainly as people think about this, companies need to adapt to succeed, and they need to focus on what the future is. You can be really good at what you do, but later on, it may not be what you do that is what makes you successful as an organization. And this really falls to leadership, and leadership being the key area and the key focus in terms of looking at the vision and the direction in the future, whether it be a small organization, a small company, a family business, or potentially the family themselves, or a large corporation, and focusing on the direction. Do you see anything in regards to a real difference between any of those levels, or is it really all the same no matter what size or scope?
It applies to all levels, and you use the term leadership, and the tone for the speed at which we respond to change is often driven by leadership, right? And you pointed out how at one level, leaders can focus on just being good at their knitting, at their core competencies, and at what. How do you balance building your strength in what you have traditionally been good at versus also experimenting with the new capabilities that might make you more relevant or more competent in the future? And this is the constant leadership dilemma, is how do we allocate our time on building strength versus how do we allocate a budget on trying out new things that we're not yet good at, but if we don't master them, there is that we will be irrelevant. And so, we did do a survey on asking 2,100 people what we thought the competencies of a future leader might be. And I'll throw one back to you. What do you think we might have found? When we ask for seven dimensions of the agile leader of tomorrow, and what would a leader need to be promotable in an organization, what do you think one or two of the things might have come out?
Well, certainly, I think certainly flexibility or the ability to be adaptable would be probably one of the biggest things. Adaptable meaning dealing with change management and change leadership would be something that would be right up there at the top, at least in my mind.
Yep. Yeah, we put that one under a trait called being intrapreneurial, right? And that's really about how do you seek out new opportunities and motivate others to think, imagine, and act in bold, enterprising ways. And that's the change management part. If you can't lead people towards change and give them a good rationale for why they should change, and that rationale can be both carrot and stick, right? Here's the incentive to change. Here's how our world is better if we change. But also, carrots don't motivate people, unfortunately, as much as sticks. It's here are the potential bad consequences if we don't change, and making sure that folks understand that. So that was one. But I'll say, overall, we identified seven, and four of them were around leading the ability to produce results. So being entrepreneurial is one. Being future focused is a second. How are people good at articulating complexity and helping anticipate what's coming next? There's no point in saying, hey, here's what we should do about what's happening now. Smart leaders are saying, here's what we may need to respond to, and here's what I think is coming. And just sort of a little bit more of articulating possibilities of where the puck might be, which is different than actually predicting where it might be. The third one was accountability. And this was a surprising one, is leaders are expected now to be a lot more accountable for A, their wins, but B, their losses, right? Take some responsibility for what didn't work out and show that you've learned from them. There is no more, hero leader, he who knows all, those leaders, their day is gone. And people want to see leaders who try, sometimes fail, acknowledge what didn't work, and own that. And the fourth one was on transparency, which very simply is communicating and sharing information on a regular basis. So those were the four on results. And then we had three others on essentially, look, if you don't get results, you don't get to be in a leadership position. But then the second part of it is, okay, I get results. Now, how do I get those results? And so the other three were on the ability to engage people. One was being inclusive. You know, that's our usual narrative of building diversity and inclusion as a value within the organization. And the science is in. Different points of view lead to different solutions, especially when circumstances are less than clear. The second one was being a people developer, enabling individuals to learn and being not just a good learner, but being enabling others to learn, being a good teacher of others. And the third one, which was the most surprising new one, was being team intelligent. And that's this idea that no longer are our best performers individuals. And this has tremendous implications for performance reviews, by the way. No longer do we think about, oh, who in our organization, what individuals are performing the best. We're now looking at an environment where it says, what clusters of people as a group are performing best as a team, and how do we reward and recognize and move those teams around? Because the problems and the job tasks of today are no longer really being done by individuals, and the performance isn't attributable to individuals. It's attributable to teams. So you really now need to recognize these team entities, reward these team entities, and promote these team entities, and that is a massive shift in thinking of how we engage others.
We're talking with Kevin McCulhy. He is the Future Workplace Experience author. 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. And, of course, you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and I'm your host, David Chilo. You know, Kevin, you talk a little bit about the changes that are happening in the workplace, and I think you'll agree, as I think the research shows, it is changing faster and faster every year. It's technology-driven, but, in fact, if you look at it, it's more than technology. It's also the way people are thinking. It's the amount of information that they're receiving. It's the way they're getting that information and the fact that they're just thinking different as an employee. How much did that go into what you talk about here, the future workplace experience?
We saw at a very high trend, and we talked about one of the trends in depth here, how technology transformed the workplace. But there was two other uber trends. The first one was the consumerization of the workplace. It's essentially what workers expect from work and how and why companies are creating employee experiences to mirror consumer experiences. So all those trends that you listed that are impacting work first showed up as up to people in the consumer environment, right? People have become social media addicts. So there's an expectation of frequent updates or Twitter. We call it Twitter speed versus Facebook speed versus Snapchat speed, right? These are practices that we have learned or become addicted to outside of work, and we're showing up to work and implementing ways in our work environment to mimic the practices that we have in our consumer environment. Other ones are the level of responsiveness we expect from employees from our employers. When we get Amazon shipping stuff in 24 hours, or we get rapid speed of response as consumers, and then we show up at work and our IT desk is not getting back to us for 3 or 4 days, or HR department is not getting back to us for 3 or 4 days, or we're not getting resolution in a few days, when our work experience does not mirror our consumer experience, that's what's fueling the shift in work. It's not that this is happening in work first. And that's why we call the book the Future Workplace Experience, and how it really is one of the big Uber trends is the consumer behaviors that are reshaping and setting the expectations for all of that. And then the third one is just the changing composition of the workforce. You look left, you look right, the people we work with no longer look and think and act like the people we worked with 10 or 20 years ago. We have a different mix of gender, of generation, of gig economy workers. Some of our workers are full-timers, some of them are part-timers. So even just the nature of the composition of who we work with has changed the speed and transparency and nature of how we work and share information at the speed at which we do.
You're absolutely right. That speed has been critical to what has changed out there. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. We're talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is talking about the future workplace experience, and we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with the one, the only, Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. Kevin, we've talked a little bit about the overview of the book and why it's so important. I think it's fair to say that you have 10 rules that you have in this book for mastering disruption in recruiting and engaging employees. I'm sure, I am confident the listeners today are interested in knowing what they are. But I will say that after this show, everybody can go to hrpowerhour.com. You can click on the information about Kevin, and you can also click on where to buy the book. So I want to make sure that we let people know that the book will be available by one click away to make that happen. All right, so Kevin, let's talk about the 10 rules that you have here. Let's start with the first one. Number one, to accomplish the goals, you have 10 rules. One, make the workplace an experience. Now, I have said before that millennials want an experience, but you say it's not just millennials, it's everyone.
Exactly, exactly. So the way we organized our 10 rules and why we needed rules was, you can articulate and explain and highlight trends all day long, but essentially what readers and listeners may want to know is fundamentally, yeah, but what do I do about it? So each of these rules is geared towards helping you think about what you can do about it. So the first rule, and the first three rules are really part of what work, how do you respond to the shift in expectations of what workers expect from work? And the first one is essentially make the workplace an experience. And we talked about this idea of consumerization, consumer expectations or consumerization entering the workplace. Well, fundamentally and underlying this consumerization is this idea of consumer-grade experiences in your workplace. And we said, number one, emotional experience, right? How are you creating and connecting companies to a more purpose-driven organization? Why does this organization exist? And connecting people to the why the organization exists, right? The second one was the intellectual experience. A lot of folks now value learning. A common interview question from candidates to employers is, what am I going to learn, or how am I going to learn here? And answering the question in advance of, here's how we'll develop you intellectually, here's how you're going to learn and evolve here, is a second big expectation. The third one is the physical experience. The dark gray cubes that I started in 20 years ago are completely unacceptable to the modern candidate. What is this work environment that you expect me to work in, and how does that work environment enhance and promote the goals of the company? The fourth one is the technology experience, right? We spoke a lot about the importance of technology, but do not expect me as a candidate to enter a company with less than consumer grade technologies or worse technology experiences than I'm experiencing outside of work. And lastly, and this one is becoming one of the most important ones, is the cultural experience. And this is essentially what is the culture, the how we do things around here, and that's our culture. And our culture is fundamentally, a lot of people talk about the culture being the aspirations of what's on the wall and the five key values. Well, frankly, your culture is the worst behavior you tolerate. The old adage is you leave bad bosses. Well, actually, you leave bad behaviors. People are leaving bad behaviors by managers, by peers, by the company, and a company tolerating bad behaviors. And if your culture is tolerating bad behaviors, people will leave. And frankly, engagement, the culture is how we do things around here, and engagement is how we feel about how we do things around here. And if how we do things around here is poor, then how we do things around here is poor, and we are leaving. So that's essentially the workplace as an experience, which is the lead chapter of the book because it shapes everything else.
It really is. When you really think about it, you're really talking about the fact that we're looking at engaging employees, and especially in today's day and age where it's really become a candidate's market, and companies are really looking for top and the best talent out there. I think that experience that somebody has at an organization really is critical to making sure that it's a long-term fit. There's no question about it.
Our second rule, right? This idea of rule two is using space to promote the culture. And what does our space need to be? And it's not just the open desk versus the closed office debate. There's a lot of different ways to think about workspace. One is, as we talked about culture, how does it actually promote culture? How does it facilitate generational changes and shifts in working style preferences, right? How does it promote engagement and collaboration among employees? Open spaces tend to promote more collaboration. How does it allow me choice? A lot of people now get their work done in multiple different spaces within the office environment during the course of the day. It's no longer go to one designated space, do all your work there, and leave that space. How does the space promote wellness? If you don't have a healthy workspace, you are not promoting the goodness and the benefit of employees. And there's now a new standard out called the WELL standard, for example, that it actually ranks and it helps employers evaluate how healthy their workplace is for employees. And lastly, how do you nurture community values? One of the biggest and most fastest values in the marketplace was WeWork, companies like WeWork. How are these companies, these co-working spaces, generating so much market value and so much demand? And when you look at these co-working spaces, you realize that they're actually curated communities with community managers who go and basically make sure that every day there's something at that space for the community to enhance the community. And the question we posed in the book is, what if actually each of your corporate buildings had a community manager that just curates how that community engages and interacts during the day and brings back this sense of community into the workplace again, which is what external companies are paying for? So that's the second one, is how do you use space to promote culture?
You know, it's interesting you're talking really about culture not only being individual of how the leaders provide it, but it's also the internal culture, right? The people that are there in the organization. Sometimes there's what I call a culture behind a culture. And that part of it is really important as much as the actual physical culture of the organization. Can you just talk about that for a second?
And this is actually one of the end outcomes of our third one, being an agile leader. This idea that culture is about behaviors, and there's some behaviors that are made explicit in our do's and don'ts. And I think what you were getting at is there are some behaviors we can only observe. We show up, and you can sort of sniff out the culture by how people are implicitly, the implicit culture, how people are behaving or expect you to behave, but nobody ever said it. Right? I noticed that this meeting always starts on time, or I noticed that we have to dress a certain way, or I noticed that certain people are treated a certain way. We notice them, but they're not written down. But collectively, what they all are, when people say culture, everybody knows what it is, but everybody has a difficulty in defining it. It's shared beliefs, it's shared values, it's shared behaviors. It's what, fundamentally, it's the behaviors that peers hold other peers accountable to, or the behaviors of what happens when the leader leaves the room. How do peers treat each other? What do peers expect of each other? What do peers tolerate of each other? That's the culture. And the more we can tap into the positives of that that help us with our corporate objectives and help people feel like they're in a, yes, this is the family I want to belong in, this is the types of behaviors that I want to be part of, and this is what I enjoy. Candidates are now seeking out companies where there's a cultural fit. Because candidates today, if there's not a cultural fit, they are leaving. They don't care about the paycheck. They don't care about the promotions. If it's not a good fit for me and I don't feel good about the behaviors of the people around me, I'm out of here. And that's the essence of what the culture is tightening up the behaviors of everyone around us.
We're talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, the 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. We're going through those rules. We've certainly talked about the first of the 10 rules, make the workplace an experience. We just finished the second one, use space to promote culture. The third one, be an agile leader. Explain why that's so important, even though I know we talked a little bit about it in the first session, but let's talk a little bit more of what an agile leader really needs to be.
Yeah, so in this future workplace that we're all going to be part of, a new generation of leaders will be needed who are agile, essentially who can adapt to a rapidly shifting business landscape, right? And when we asked folks what traits these agile leaders needed to demonstrate, we got this constant balance of, yes, you have to get the results, and we talked about being transparent and how you're clear on communications, on essentially being accountable, right? There's a new level of accountability for results. And that also means acknowledging failures. And people are in a fast-changing environment. Think about, what is our culture towards failure? How do we treat initiatives that didn't work out? In old corporate environments, if your business case didn't make it, or your initiative got failed, you were demoted or moved laterally. In the modern environment, if you're seen to be the type of person who takes new, I'll say, measured risks, who tries new things, and the point of an experiment is to learn. The point of an experiment is not to necessarily succeed. It's what did we learn from that experiment that we can feed back into formulas for success. And I think if I was to go through all the traits, that one trait of that willingness to try new things, that willingness to experiment and own the outcomes, good or bad, and to share those learnings, if you can do that or hire people who are willing to do that, that's the singular trait that will make employees more successful to embrace a changing environment over and above anything else.
You're absolutely right. It's very, very important. The fourth.
The fourth rule. So then we move into three rules that are in a category of how technology transforms the workplace. And we talked about the broader way of rule four is really consider technology an enabler and a disruptor. And so you have to see both sides of the technology. And we talked about enabler as enabling our workflows through just enhancing our productivity. We talked earlier about how to use it as an enhancer, meaning enhance our capabilities. It's person plus machine. How do we use it as an advisor to make better decisions? And so if you don't have a data analytics play, you are not a relevant company for the modern environment. And as a disruptor, how do we bring technology in to disrupt our workflows and essentially automate? If we're not looking for ways to automate, we will be automated ourselves. So rule four is really just a broader mindset of technology, and then that set up the next two rules about specific uses of technology.
You're absolutely right. It does make a difference, and we've talked a lot about the technology having such a huge impact. The last one we're talking about this segment is a rule, is build a data-driven recruiting ecosystem. That's a lot of words there, Kevin.
Yes. This fundamentally is the use of technology just focused on the recruiting side, right? And technology now has all but eliminated passive candidates. And what I mean by passive candidates, right now technology is being used. If you're not reaching out to candidates before they reach out to you, you're not doing recruiting right. And so the burden has shifted from candidates looking for opportunities at companies to companies using technology to identify candidates that they want to woo to apply. And that's a massive shift. And that the ecosystem part, the data-driven ecosystem, recruiting ecosystem, is really one, managing your employer brand. Your employer brand, what do you stand for as an employer, is different than what you stand for in the minds of consumers. And companies are now distinguishing and making sure that they brand themselves differently as a place of employment than they do to brand themselves as a service or a product that they're trying to sell. Two, we're seeing a lot more training before hiring and finding ways to actually see and test that employee in an actual real-life environment versus just the interview process. Thirdly, the smart sourcing, this is where companies are increasingly taking advantage of LinkedIn and other tools to target who they want and start reaching out to those employees and bring them in, reel them in to the company, invite them to an open house, say, have you considered working for us? The outbound recruiting is shifting in power and focus, and that's very data-driven. The fourth one, employees referrals. We have 15% of employees who are coming back again to work at companies. We're calling those boomerang employees. But we also see an emergence in tapping the alumni of employers and having the alumni of the company, the former employees, reach out and be a source of referral candidates because they know what it was like. And companies are now embracing people who used to work at the company versus once they were shifted out, they were sort of abandoned. And lastly, being transparent with job seekers. Fundamentally, and to all our listeners here, we in the HR community, our behaviors continue to be atrocious in the timeliness with which we get back to candidates and how we maintain communication and transparency with those candidates and on where they are in the process. And it's the one thing that really, of all the other changes, this transparency with candidates and where you are in the process and what you can expect of the process going forward is the one area that any company, whether you're hiring 2 employees a year or 20,000 employees a year, that transparency of where you are in the process and the speed of that is the one thing that people can do tomorrow. Get back to the people who've put in the effort of applying.
Great advice. We're talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. I'm your host, David Chulo. This is the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today I want to, as always, thank our sponsors. They're very important to the show. They're why we're here in regards to being able to provide you educational programming each and every week. Our sponsors, Jackson Lewis, All We Do Is Work, Redmond Winchell, Counselors at Law, Sheehan Finney, Verrill Dana, Strategic HR, all great sponsors of the HR Power Hour, and we thank them very much. We are talking with Kevin Mulcahy. We're talking about the future workplace experience, 10 rules for mastering disruption in recruiting and engaging employees. He's got a great book on Amazon and other places across the platforms. I highly recommend you pick it up. It is a great book. I've had an opportunity to go through it myself. And as I've said before, I saw Kevin speak just a couple months ago. He's a very engaging speaker. I'd encourage you to contact him for that. Kevin, we've been talking about the 10 rules that have been provided in regards to how to make this work at your organization. First rule was make the workplace an experience. Second rule is use space to promote culture. Third, be an agile leader. Four, consider technology an enabler and disruptor. And then five, build a data-driven recruiting ecosystem. We went through those, and I thought what we'd do in the second segment is talk about the last five, starting with number six, embrace on-demand learning.
Yes, so in our book, The Future Workplace Experience, three of the chapters are targeted towards technology. And rule six is another specific application of technology and how technology is reshaping the workplace. And the future of learning requires really fundamentally reimagining how we help learners learn at the speed of our business. And that means fundamentally five things. One is shifting the mindset to on-demand learning. A lot of companies now say, okay, we're doing a session, come into our class, it's at this hour, it's at this time, it's at this place, please attend. That thinking is gone. Learning is 24/7. It is where you want to learn it, how you want to learn it, and it's mobile enabled. Two is the vision for learning. We're seeing learning organizations who basically have traditionally assumed, well, employees know they've got to learn. It's like vegetables. It's good for them. Therefore, they should consume. And now we're seeing a lot more branding of learning and development organizations. And our favorite story in the book was the Adidas Group, who had a great vision statement for their learning, which was, you learn, we grow. And basically, you have to market helping employees consume learning just as how you market helping customers consume your product or services. Thirdly, is expanding the learning opportunities. Learning used to be what we fed up to you within the company, and now there are perfectly good sources out there on, let's call it TEDx or edX or YouTube or wherever you want to go, where people are now becoming curators of learning and bringing in a lot more outside content that's not traditionally being included in the classroom. Fourthly, MOOCs, massive open online courses. Especially in the last 18 months, there's been a rapid proliferation of online courses for businesses where people are taking university-grade courses online, and companies are acknowledging the completion of those courses and taking them into consideration for internal advancement evaluations. And finally, it's communicating the value of learning. And this one cannot be understated, is we just assume that it's obvious to people that they need to learn. We assume that they know that it's good for them. And just like our customers, we cannot emphasize enough how important it is to keep, and I'll say like Simon Sinek, start with the why. Help people essentially understand why they need to invest in their own learning and how it will benefit them. Because people need a why to learn. And if you don't give them the why they need to learn here, then that singular ability to convince them on their why will propagate this mindset in the first place towards being a learner. And if employees aren't learners, they're not going to be the employees that you will want in the company in the future. They're not relevant to the future.
You know, this next, number seven, tap the power of multiple generations, is something that I've talked about for many times. I mean, there's a big buzz about talking about millennials, and that's important because it is now the largest workplace group. But this intergenerational connection, using all the generations to really have the power, is 100% correct. Tell me a little bit about your take on this.
Yeah, so quite simply, the multi-generation is really age diversity is what we're talking about here. And age diversity is now what is driving the type of creative thinking that is leading to greater engagement in innovation. And I think we're departing from, oh, let's learn everything from the millennials and bring millennial preferences into the organization and have that influence everyone else. We've gone through that phase, and a number of millennial preferences were actually the hidden preferences of other folks too. You know, older employees appreciated the improvements in space or the improvements in workplace flexibility or the improvements in work management and some of the new technologies that millennials drove into the workplace. But now we have to recognize the composition, step back and see how the composition overall is about age diversity. And thinking about our ability to understand the similarities, the differences, and the expectations of each generational cohort in our business. And so what we did with this chapter is we laid out for each of the generations, we laid out the differences at three levels. One, the personal level. What do workers want for themselves? And each generation tends to want different things for themselves. At the team level, what do workers seek of colleagues? Each generation tends to expect how to work differently with their colleagues in a different way. And the third one is, what do workers expect of the organization? And if we can help each generation understand what the other generations expect, it's not that we're doing things for one particular generation. It's we recognize we're in a multi-generational workplace, just like other diversity and inclusiveness training, and age diversity is another form of inclusiveness. And we need to understand where different generations tend to come from and look for ways to meet people where they are. And that's just the reality of a modern workplace. We have now have most businesses will now have five generations in the workplace.
You're exactly right. You know, you talk about these tips, and again, we're talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. We're talking about number 8 next, which is build gender equality. You say build it. This has been a hot topic across the platforms politically. But what are you really talking about in regards to companies themselves building gender equality internally?
And if we had a chance to re-edit, I would call this one now building gender equity is what we were really getting at versus equality. And I want to just draw the distinction of equality is treating everybody the same, and equity is treating everybody appropriate to what they need for leveling the playing field. So there is a combination of equality and equity here. But what we're seeing from the data is women are now the more educated part of the new workforce, right? More women are exiting colleges than men. And more women are starting to enter the workforces at the junior levels than men. And yet we still have this whole earning 78% of the salaries of their male counterpart sort of shadow over the discussion of men versus women in the workplace. So where it comes down to is a need for workplaces to actually be more holistic in how they think about promoting inclusive workplaces for women. And there's a lot of unconscious bias about characteristics of individuals by gender. And so rather than making this specifically about a gender part, we're seeing a lot of the gender biases being, as we just covered earlier, under the age biases, we're seeing this overall umbrella of all part of inclusiveness training and unconscious bias. And we basically came up with a number of strategies that companies can consider to address their unconscious bias. Number one is you have to measure. You really do have to track gender representation to even have the conversation. Two, being mindful of subtle cues, who's included, who's not. When you have panels, do we have a mix of genders? In all of our public-facing and internal-facing activities, are we aware that we're curating a mix of genders, and our lack of mix of gender, what does that say about us? Three, the big one is, if you see something, say something. We're seeing a lot more companies basically saying, if they see something, they're calling people out on it and say, that was inappropriate, that was a biased move, that's not the types of unconscious bias that we're going to tolerate around here, and we need you to change. It's unconscious bias because people often don't realize they're doing it until somebody else points it out. Those are the three big ones, but fundamentally it's about paying attention to prevailing gender assumptions, and being accountable for personally and for the team on how we source and promote individuals different from ourselves by gender, by age, by culture. And basically, if we see behaviors or examples of unconscious bias, the faster our culture allows us to call them out, the better. Some people do it in the meetings. Some people are doing it right after the meetings. Some people are doing it in follow-ups. But if you're not saying anything, then the biases will prevail. And we need to create an environment that allows people to point out examples of unconscious bias, especially important when we're dealing with gender and gender representation.
The ninth one you talk about is plan for more gig economy workers. You know, it just so happens next week we're going to have someone you know very well come on the show and talk to us about her book, The Gig Economy. But, you know, you say plan for more gig economy workers. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's two parts of the gig economy. Let's talk about the workplace of the future, or the workforce of the future, won't all be full-time employees. It will be made up of contractors, freelancers, part-time employees, and other independent workers. And all these categories are collectively known as the gig economy. And it is a really fast-growing segment. This non-full-time worker segment is a really fast-growing segment. And the data indicates that HR leaders will need to plan for a shift from managing a workforce of almost all full-time employees to managing a more blended workforce of employees and independent gig economy workers. The two sides are one, and I think in your next week's conversation, you're going to hear about the perspective from the individual and what drives the individual gig economy worker to actually think about managing their career as a series of portfolios or a series of gigs rather than one job. But from our perspective, we think about it as what are the implications to employers when you're dealing with people who actually don't want a full-time job? How do you deal with this blended workforce in helping you get your work done? And what we're seeing is, and I'm sure we're all familiar with the rideshare apps, etc., which fundamentally match want a ride? Well, here's a guy with a car. Book your ride, book your restaurant, book your slot. And what we're seeing internally in companies is the unbundling of a job into assignments. And think of your full-time job as broken into a series of assignments and internal platforms that are saying, we need somebody to spend the next 3 months writing this plan to do this. And people bidding for it and matching assignments, matching the role and the employees internally, and companies basically saying, everybody's getting the salary, but we're going to have you change assignments every 3 or 4 weeks or months within the company, and it's going to become more of a assignment matching way of doing business. So we capitalize on everybody's strongest skills. We've seen consulting companies, by the way, this is not new. It's just new. It's just spreading more broadly. We've seen consulting companies do this a lot. We've seen ad agencies do this a lot, and now we're seeing regular companies start to implement this a lot. Companies that range from Cisco to Pricewaterhouse are putting in these assignment matching platforms within their company to match people for the tasks they need to implement their strategies right now. Go get those tasks done, and then you're put back in the pool and ready for reassignment to the next task. And it changes HR dynamics tremendously, creates chaos to org charts. But what it does on the other side is it allows companies to execute their strategies with greater speed and greater nimbleness than they could do before.
All right, and then the last one, of course, as we're talking about these, is the number 10, be a workplace activist.
Essentially, a workplace activist is someone who gives voice to making the changes that we desire in our organization. And workplace activists do one of three things. They recognize that their job is not their job. Their job is to help the company win. And the second one is they reframe the job description to say, what is it that I am doing in my job to help my company win in a volatile, uncertain, ambiguous marketplace? And thirdly, an activist breaks things that aren't broken. And you look at processes and you say, what can we improve? Because if you just fix what's broken, you raise to average. But if you go break what isn't broken, you reinvent your workplace. And that's really the chapter that we use to bring together all the rules, that there's a mindset needed to break things and change things and be an activist for change.
We're talking with Kevin Mulcahy, and of course we're talking about the Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. As we wrap up the show here, Kevin, tell us one or two things that you want to make sure people take away from when they read your book.
I'm going to go with the title. The Future Workplace Experience, it fundamentally is, one, making sure the workplace is an experience, two, how you think about technologies to transform that experience, and three, paying attention to the full composition of your workplace and including in that composition the gig economy workers, because not everybody needs to be a full-time employee, and you've got to have just a broader, more inclusive strategy for including different types of workers and mindsets and attitudes. And lastly, I'll say to everybody, experiment. Set a culture of experimentation and try new things and try new practices and call them experiments. Don't call them, here's the new way we're going to do things. Call them, here's what we're going to try to do and see if that works out. And if it's not working, we're going to kill it. And if it is working, we're going to do more of it. Experiment, experiment, experiment will help you be adaptive to the fast-changing future workplace.
We've been talking with Kevin Mulcahy. He is the author of The Future Workplace Experience, 10 Rules for Mastering Disruption in Recruiting and Engaging Employees. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much, David.
And, of course, you can go to hrpowerhour.com right after the show, and you will find your way to connect with Kevin directly or, of course, buy his book, The Future Workplace Experience. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VerylDana.com.
This is Tawny Alvarez with Veryl Dana. Do you have a pessimistic Pete or a negative Nancy in the office? Is he or she bringing down the morale of your team or simply a difficult person to deal with? So often, when an event warranting discipline occurs, employers will add a host of additional, quote-unquote, personality conflicts that they have dealt with the employee. The problem is, a review of the individual's personnel file rarely, if ever, indicates that the individual has been coached or spoken to regarding his or her poor attitude. Similar to inadequate or deficient performance, make sure that you are regularly communicating with employees about appropriate and inappropriate attitude and the effect it is having on the team or productivity generally. This doesn't have to be an initial written warning, but can simply be a verbal discussion about how his or her attitude is affecting the team. Contact myself or a member of Veryl Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group if you'd like to further discuss best practices as to how to handle pessimistic employees.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerylDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Jim Reedy, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney, will be our guest, and he will be back to talk about the 10 essential workplace policies and why every employer needs them. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.